it's time for Paisano Days, Friday, September 18th and Saturday, September 19th at the South City Park by Tiger Field in Reading. 2 days of homemade Italian food, including a spaghetti dinner, meatball sandwiches, pasta bowl with meatball, Italian sausage sandwiches, hot dogs, cannoli and ice cream, beer on tap, and wine. Entrance to the event is free, and guests will enjoy vendor booths, raffles, a silent auction, and watching the bocce tournament. The dinner cost is $16 for adults and $6 for kids under 12. Sons and Daughters of Italy hosted this event in support of many charities in our area, including the Wings of Angels, the Police Canine Program, student scholarships, and many more. That's Paisano Days on September 18th and 19th at South City Park. Call 5305-101903 for more information. That's 5305-101903.
From the historic campus of Hillsdale College in Hillsdale, Michigan, where the good, the true, and the beautiful are taught, nurtured, and honored, this is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour, bringing the activity and education of the college to listeners across the country.
Think globally, act locally. This was very popular in the 90s with the environmental movement. And it sounds kind of intriguing at first. It's proposed that people think locally and act locally.
This is your host, Scott Bertram. Welcome to the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour, part of the Hillsdale College Podcast Network. That was Seth Baron, author of the recent book, Weaponized, The Left's Capture and Destruction of America's Sacred Institutions. We talk in depth with Seth about his book today, and later on, Elizabeth Fredericks from Hillsdale's English Department joins us. She'll begin a brief series on British literature of World War I. First, we're joined by Seth Baron. He is an editorial board member at the New York Post, reporter and editor, and he's also the author of the recent book, Weaponized, The Left's Capture and Destruction of America's Sacred Institutions. Seth, thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you for having me on. It's a pleasure.
So the title of the book is Weaponized, and we've heard the term weaponization a lot more recently than, say, 15, 20 years ago. What do you mean by weaponization as you use the phrase throughout the book?
Well, I'm looking at the ways in which certain key institutions in America, and I'm talking about civics, I'm talking about education, policing, and housing, these key institutions that really define the way Americans live, they've been infiltrated, subverted, and turned against the people through a weaponization of, I guess, you know, sort of our good nature and our sense of what's right. Okay, for instance, take the term the American dream. This used to refer to how Americans saw their lives in regard to how their children would grow up. Mm-hmm. You know, Americans sought to provide for their kids, get a house, take vacations, and maybe their kids would do better than they did. But at some point, American dream came to mean it, not something that Americans aspired to, but something that foreigners had. Americans no longer were participants in the American dream. The American dream was something that we owed to non-Americans, to people abroad, all of whom had a right to it. So by twisting this phrase, they were able to, you know, in my thesis, is to change the way we view citizenship and make it that we no longer really have the right to determine who comes here, and that it's essentially a global right.
And immigration, citizenship is one of the four main topics in the book Weaponized. We're concerned about the meaning of citizenship and especially about assimilation too. When a country stops expecting newcomers to assimilate into a common national culture, what do we lose?
I mean, we lose any sense of unity. We lose the sense of the nation as a nation. It just becomes a place for people to come and hang their hat, like a clearinghouse. It becomes a place where foreigners come in and they say, well, we don't really like the nation, but we like what you've done with the place. We think we'll turn it into something else. So you wind up with society of disconnected people, people who have very low trust in one another, you basically wind up with something that's not really quite a nation anymore, so much as it is just like an entrepot, like a collection of people who are in a place for commercial reasons and nothing else.
Seth Baron, the book is Weaponized, The Left's Capture and Destruction of America's Sacred Institutions. Citizenship, policing, housing, education, those are the four quadrants you write about in Weaponized. And you argue early, if you control the operation of those institutions, you're in a pretty good spot to control the country. How, why did you identify those four places as being the centralized place to turn our focus?
Well, when I started thinking about the country in general, and I wanted to write a book about, you know, when I saw the problems that were happening, mainly from the left, it occurred to me that, okay, the way America was founded is the idea that the people are sovereign, and all power stems from the people, not from a king, not from the top, but from the people whom God has invested self-evidently with liberty and, you know, natural rights of self-government, basically. And so in the American system, power derives from the bottom and through the communities and then up to the states and into the country. Well, this drives the left crazy because they have a universal vision that they want to impose everywhere all at once. So it's annoying to them to have to consult every different district, every different community and gain consensus that way. They would prefer just to, you know, they have their diktats and they'd like to just impose them from the top. So it seemed that what was happening was that power was being lifted from the bottom and away from the people and raised up to these unaccountable levels, like people who have no accountability to the base, essentially an expert class should rule everything. And it occurred to me, yeah, this is the problem. The left wants to capture all the power, and they do it by, here's the thing. I don't know if you've heard this phrase before. Think globally, act locally. This was very popular in the 90s with the environmental movement. And it sounds kind of intriguing at first. It's like, oh, yeah, we should think globally, you know, have like a general vision of things and then act locally. I propose that people like think locally and act locally. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the real American, that's the American spirit that we've kind of lost.
Seth Baron is with us. The book Weaponized, The Left's Capture and Destruction of America's Sacred Institutions. On policing, you point out that those who advocate for defunding the police always have this picture of some harmonious society that emerges afterwards, not one of lawlessness. And there's this discussion of root causes of crime, and the root causes for our friends on the left never are going back to the actual person committing the crime. When they talk about defunding in the society that emerges without police, are they in a sense saying that police are the root cause of crime in our cities?
Well, that is, I think, that's a thesis that goes back to like the 19th century with certain radical thinkers who said, yes, the cause of laws are sent. The idea being that laws are put in place in order to protect capital and to protect the elite. And then the police are there to essentially just carry that out. And the idea being like as Zohran Mamdani has said, violence is just a construct. The idea of, so he would say that having landlords is a form of violence. Having prisons is a form of violence. Having, you know, punishment as we know it is violence. These are all means of using this, of state power to control people. So what they would like to do is, well, they say what they'd like to do is to undo these strictures and these modes of state power and institutional control and come up with a more humane society. I think what they really are mad about is the idea that the police are a recipient of public taxes, public revenue, that they don't, the left actually cannot control. So I think they basically would like to sort of nationalize the police, basically bring the police under their umbrella, the same way they did for the teachers and for, you know, certain other public sector groups. But yeah, I mean, they do make a very radical argument that, mm-hmm. that policing is, you know, essentially they say it evolved out of slave catching. Practice in the 1850s or so, where they would deputize people to go out and find slaves and catch them. They see the modern police department as directly connected to the old slave catchers. That's what police are. They're just people out to enforce modern day slavery.
Talking with Seth Barron. His book is Weaponized. We'll continue in just a moment. I'm Scott Bertram. This is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
The only real estate agent I trust right here in Redding and Shasta County is Josh Barker with Josh Barker Real Estate. Now, thanks for joining me today.
Thanks for having me, Sean.
Now, what happens when someone comes to you and needs to move because of a job or family reasons, or maybe they're on a tight deadline to sell that home?
You know, it's a great question, and there's some really good news to that. It just means you're going to shift your focus when you decide on your pricing. In some cases, people test the market and, you know, try a price that's not proven. But in other cases, what you do is you actually look at recent sales data, you price it accordingly, and in many cases, you sell it faster and even for more money anyhow. But if that's not fast enough, don't worry. We offer an instant offer program where we can purchase your home in 2 weeks or less and get you moved from point A to point B.
All right. Thanks for keeping us up to date. Talk to the only agent in town I recommend. Go online to reddinghomes.com. That's Redding, R-E-D-D-I-N-G, homes.com, or just Google Josh Barker.
Business is booming at Redding Heating and Air, and we have a simple philosophy. Our neighbors deserve elite talent. We are looking for the absolute best service technicians and installers in the North State.
That's right. We aren't just looking to fill a seat. We're looking for pros who take pride in their craft and care about the community we serve.
If you're at the top of your game, you belong in a company that respects your expertise. Because here, we take the trust of our neighbors personally.
We're hiring service technicians and installers right now. We offer the best compensation in town because we believe the best of the best deserve to be treated that way.
If you're a seasoned pro ready to lead in a company where excellence is the standard, we want you on our team.
No joke. We've got the work. If you've got the skills, come join the family.
Service technicians and installers, apply today to Redding Heating and Air. Visit reddingheatingair.com to submit your application. Redding Heating and Air, old-fashioned service, modern-day solutions.
Stay informed with our county's most reliable news. Tune to KCNR every Monday at 6:35 a.m. for the Town Hall Brief during the Sue McLean News Hour. Known for its unbiased reporting, the Town Hall Brief provides precise, local-only updates and compelling discussions critical to our community. Have a lead? Email townhallbriefs@gmail.com or reach out via socials at townhallbrief on linktree.com to send a DM. The Town Hall Brief, the authoritative source for Shasta County news, Monday mornings at 6:35 on KCNR.
Shasta County. Tired of filtered news? Welcome to Shasta Unfiltered, your trusted online newspaper for the North State. Straight facts on Redding politics, city council moves, local events, and the national stories that actually hit your wallet, like federal funding changes and job trends right here at home. No agenda, no paid spin disguised as news. Just honest reporting and the stories you need. Visit ShastaUnfiltered.com. Your community reported right.
Hi friends, RC here from Tobacco and Brew, sharing this month's Cigar of the Humidor. H. Upman Sunrise, grown, fermented, and aged at the A.J. Fernandez factory. This stick is medium in body, offering an Ecuadorian Connecticut seed wrapper, along with robust, hand-selected Nicaraguan long filler. Notes of coffee, cedar, and nuts make this a perfect cigar for any time of day. Get yours today at Tobacco and Brew, Redding, California.
What is happening in the state of Jefferson? To find out, listen to the Jefferson State of Mind program Sunday mornings at 9 a.m. on KCNR with your hosts Wynn Carpenter and Terry Raposa and Janet Chandler. To catch up on past broadcasts or to listen anytime, go to KCNR1460.com and click on the archive link.
Come out and play. Have you seen the bill? We all have to pay. time has come for 51 in a Jefferson state of mind.
We're back on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. I'm Scott Bertram. Seth Barron is with us from the New York Post, also author of the recent book Weaponized, The Left's Capture and Destruction of America's Sacred Institutions. Seth, we see this time and again when we have some of these far left progressive candidates, socialist candidates, DSA candidates, who are talking about defunding the police, that their support does not come largely from the communities that these policies affect. How does the argument and ideology survive when the consequences are hurting the intended beneficiaries, when the beneficiaries, quote unquote, don't even support the policies?
You know, that's a great question. And, you know, for instance, you know, you see that the first victims of, like, defunding the police or lessening policing are people in, like, black communities, because they have the highest rates of crime and thus the highest rates of crime victimization. You know, there's this great trick on the left where they can just say, well, we haven't done it right. We didn't implement it correctly. There wasn't enough funding. There was too much resistance from the other side, so we just have to keep trying it. I mean, it's the same thing you hear when they explain why socialism is a failure everywhere it's tried.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it hasn't really been tried. It's always been hurt by American intervention, by sanctions, so sabotage. So we just have to keep going. It's a wonderful trick they have built into it that they can never be seen to fail. It's always just a question of doubling down. So, you know, and then you can just convince your followers that that's the problem. Well, you know, we just have to keep going, comrades. So, this has been going on for a long time, but it seems to keep working, which is remarkable.
Weaponized is the book, The Left's Capture and Destruction of America's Sacred Institutions. Seth Barron is the author. On housing, you argue that fair housing or affordable housing is a sneaky way for the left to wage war on the suburbs. Why do they hate the suburbs, and what do they want to do about it?
So this is kind of why they hate the suburbs. Suburbs are inhabited by people who have an investment in the community. There's more home ownership.
Right.
And homeowners are very conservative. They're very attuned to the value of their homes. This is their major asset. And the left hates this. They call it the home voter, people whose voting patterns are closely tied to how they perceive policies will affect the value of their homes. So undoing this power is key to the left's vision. And that's why they've changed zoning laws to make it that the state can determine what happens in your community, why Obama and Biden would sue communities if they didn't have enough subsidized housing for poor people. It's a very long campaign they've been waging, and it's somewhat effective.
Yeah.
And so even though suburbs are where most of the economic growth is happening in America today, that's what they don't want to admit. It's not really happening in the cities. And more than that, this idea that the suburbs are where the white people live and the cities are where the black and brown people live is also false. I think a majority of the minority population mm-hmm. lives in suburbs. That's where all of the population growth is happening. So it's an outdated model that they're addicted to. And then you wind up with leftists flocking to cities like in New York, voting for people like Mamdani. And they have this vision of the world where everyone should live in tightly dense, like, conurbations.
Mm-hmm.
Suburbs should be essentially made illegal. And, you know, there's a social control element to it. People in the cities tend to be, you know, it's hard to raise a family in a city, so there's less family formation, et cetera, et cetera. So this is the vision.
On education, Seth, it might be one of the four that has most buy-in or most acceptance that there has been a capture and a change. But it's also different because they're all alternatives, charter schools and private schools and even home schooling. Does that mean that education is the area perhaps where institutional capture can be reversed most quickly?
You know, that's a great question, and I do see it that way a little bit. I don't necessarily see that it can be reversed most quickly, but I see it as a model action, because this is one place where the teachers' unions are the most powerful unions in the country. They're the largest unions, and they put more money into politics than any other entity, I believe. Billions of dollars. This is all taxpayer money, of course. Taxpayer money that goes into the schools, goes to the teachers' unions, who have the power to negotiate their contract and have the power to, you know, affect the political system by putting money into it. So, yes, and they've taken it over. But, like you said, people have pushed back. And so there are these movements, like the charter school movement, which is incredibly popular at, you know, at the roots. Homeschooling, private education. The left wants to destroy all of these alternatives, but they've been unable to. Mm-hmm. And all of this would happen with people operating locally. And that, I, again, like this whole think locally, act locally, I really see this as the vision. That's how charter schools got going. That's how homeschooling networks evolved. So I see education and the pushback against the relentless institutional capture by the left as one, you know, as a model for how the people can start to take back America.
Seth Barron with us. The book is Weaponized. Seth, if this is institutional, the problems are institutional in these areas rather than electoral, what difference does winning elections make? How much can winning elections even begin to fix or address the problem?
Winning elections is great, okay? We need to win elections. But we also have to recognize the way the left operates. The left sees politics as something that happens every day. The right sees politics, like you said, as like the midterms and then every 4 years, the elections. The right has a lot of things going on in their day. They have jobs. They have families. Mm-hmm. They have religion. They have hobbies. For the left, politics is their religion. Politics is their love life. Politics is their social circle. Politics, in many cases, is their job because they work in the nonprofit or the government sector. So we have to take on their model, which is relentlessly being involved in politics. I mean, it's unfortunate that that's what it comes to, because nobody really wants to do that. People want to hang out with their friends at church and with their family and, you know, do projects on the weekends and mm-hmm. so forth. But we have to recognize that for the left, they're always engaged in politics, and then elections are kind of like, you know, one of the fruits. Winning elections is one of the fruits of their hard work. So elections, we definitely need to win elections, absolutely, but we have to recognize that politics is a much larger process, and it really requires a certain awakening that the left is ahead of us on this. They're always working. Like when we get up, they've been doing, you know, they're sitting at the edge of the bed waiting for us to, they've already, you know, done push-ups all night while we've been sleeping, basically.
Seth Barron is on the editorial board at the New York Post. You can find him writing elsewhere and editing places too. And the new book, Weaponized, The Left's Capture and Destruction of America's Sacred Institutions. Seth, thanks so much for joining us here on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
It's been such a pleasure. Thank you for having me on.
Up next, Dr. Elizabeth Fredericks, Associate Professor of English here at Hillsdale College, returns to begin a brief series on British literature of World War I. I'm Scott Bertram. This is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Gorman is fighting for parental rights, academic excellence, and education, not ideology. Join his fundraiser Friday, August 28th at 5 p.m. at the Anderson VFW. Dinner, prize drawings, live auction. Cashless and easy. Help us reach more voters and defend our kids' future. Friday, August 28th, 5 p.m., Anderson VFW, 3210 West Center Street. Paid for by Vote Author Gorman for Shasta County Board of Education, 2026.
Get your tickets today at VoteAuthorGorman.com. That's VoteAuthorGorman.com.
Looking for work? O2 Employment Services has been working with local job seekers for the past 20 years. If you're tired of uploading your resume and getting no response, it's time to let O2 help you find that perfect position. Oh, and by the way, you pay absolutely nothing for our service. If you'd like our help, head on over to our website at o2es.com, click apply now, and complete our online application. We have connections with over 600 local businesses. Once we have your information and understand what you're looking for, we can introduce you to all the positions you may wish to consider. We currently have over 100 available positions, and we would love to match you with the one you're looking for. O2 Employment Services, the North State's leading staffing agency. Give us a call at 530-223-4674. That's 530-223-4674. Or visit us online at o2es.com.
Looking for big wins and high-stakes excitement? Look no further than Bingo at Wind River Resort and Casino. We're shaking things up with our massive monthly $1,999 special. Life-changing jackpots are waiting. Prefer the classic feel? Don't miss our fan-favorite paper-only night. Plus, keep the adrenaline pumping with our $5 progressive game. The prize pool just keeps growing until somebody hits it big. So grab your jobbers and bring your lucky charm. Your adventure begins here at Wind River Resort and Casino.
For over 50 years, House of Realty has provided experienced and effective advice to its real estate clients. Experts in residential, commercial, and investment property, we have the knowledge and tools to assist you with all of your real estate needs. Family owned and operated since 1965, we have been an active part of the Shasta County community for generations. Please call House of Realty today at 241-8300, a reputation for excellence since 1965.
This Hawaiian mini vacation is brought to your radio by Maui Bob's Office Cleaning. So what does professional office cleaning have to do with relaxing in a tropical paradise? Frankly, nothing. But Maui Bob and the crew want to remind you to be sure to take the time for what's important in this workaday world. Family, friends, and yes, even yourself. And if their professional office cleaning services can help you make that time, give them a call at 221-5868. This Hawaiian mini vacation was brought to your radio by Maui Bob's Office Cleaning, 221-5868.
Have you stopped into Harmony yet? We'd love to welcome you in. We've thoughtfully curated brands we truly love, from Lululemon, Vuori, Free People Movement, to The Upside, alongside beautiful home goods, clean body care, candles, gifts, and everyday pieces you'll reach for again and again. We believe shopping should feel inspiring, not overwhelming. Come slow down, explore, and discover something you didn't know you needed. We're located in the heart of downtown Reading on California Street between Curated and Theory Coffee, right next to Organic Pilates. We can't wait to welcome you into Harmony.
Welcome back to the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. I'm Scott Bertram. Be sure to follow us on X at Hillsdale Radio and the Hillsdale College Podcast Network at HC Podcasts.
We're joined by Dr. Elizabeth Fredericks, Associate Professor of English here at Hillsdale College. Dr. Fredericks, thanks for returning.
Thanks for having me.
Starting a brief series here about a very interesting course that you just completed teaching, British Literature of World War One, and it's great because we have a little bit of cross-pollination here, both a little literature, a little bit of history coming through that literature as well. And we start with something that I call the war they thought they were fighting. So as World War One begins in 1914, what's the emotional tone that's dominating British writing and what's driving it?
Yeah, so the tone is of change. The poets overall are sometimes resisting the lingering traces of the Victorian era. Modernism is still in its very early stages and is mostly a fringe avant-garde movement. And so the poets who are trying to innovate away from the Victorian period are actually still very formal poets. A lot of their work is very pastoral, bucolic, sometimes a kind of rehashed romanticism. They're sometimes called the Georgian poets, after some anthologies that a number of them appeared in. And the tone of some of the poetry, including by other poets who are sort of lingering major figures that carry over from the Romantic period, like Rudyard Kipling, there's a real desire for some kind of new test of courage or national identity. There's a real hunger to prove themselves. The last war that Britain had really been in was the Boer War, which of course had very mixed results and was very far away from home. So you see this desire to kind of push and reestablish and establish masculinity and patriotism. Mm-hmm. And alongside it, then you also have this, like I said, pastoral, bucolic, romantic sort of tone of the English countryside. It's very idyllic in a lot of ways. So those are sort of kind of some of the dominant strains or modes that you see in that poetry in 1914, even before the war, and then especially once the war begins. You have major poets like Robert Graves, Rupert Brooke, Siegfried Sassoon, and D.H. Lawrence are all kind of very significant younger poets at this particular point in time. And they are, as I mentioned, also very formal poets, too. They're writing in very traditional meters and forms. Modernism hasn't made its inroads yet. Imagism and Futurism are these very avant-garde movements that are read only by very small groups and are also seen as having too much connection to either Europe or America to really be English enough to sort of satisfy the desire at this point in time.
World War I's been called the most literary war. Do you think that's right? And maybe a little bit here, too, as to how you conceived the course, why you're interested in teaching this.
Yeah, so one way I conceived the course was that I was always teaching around this period in other courses that I taught. So I regularly teach a course on Victorian and modern British literature. We always do a day on the World War I poets. Mm-hmm. We always do T.S. Eliot's The Wasteland as well. And I always do Virginia Woolf's To the Lighthouse. And all of these works have their either very explicit connection to the war, as in the case of the World War I poets. We focus primarily on Siegfried Sassoon and Wilfred Owen there especially. But To the Lighthouse also has, in that famous Time Passes sequence in the middle, some very direct references to the war and war poetry. And of course, one way to look at T.S. Eliot's The Wasteland is that it's this poet of post-war England and post-war London in particular. So those were things that I really loved them. I really enjoyed them. I also taught a course on the Bloomsbury Group. These are all writers who live through the war. They mostly don't fight in it, but they do engage in it in different ways. E.M. Forster, for instance, works in the National Gallery during the time period in which London is actually on the receiving end of some air raids and is putting like the best masterpieces in storage and putting the third-rate masterpieces on the walls, which he said felt very appropriate.
Uh-huh.
That's the correct company for him, is the third-rate masterpieces. And he also then worked in the Mediterranean identifying soldiers who were missing in action among the wounded. So you have all these connections, and I also really love some of the more recent literature that's come out about World War I by Pat Barker and Ishian Hutchinson and some other writers. And so I was just going, I really just want to pull this all together into one class and see what it's like to go through it. The big challenge of producing the class actually became how to order it, because the works are not published in the same order as the time periods they deal with. And so if we read by chronological order, we would read, for instance, The Wasteland, which is about post-war London, before we read something like David Jones's In Parentheses, which is about his actual time fighting in the war. And so we'd be constantly bouncing around time-wise. And so I actually, this went very much against my instincts in some ways, organized the course according to the time period in which the works were set, rather than the time in which they were published, in order to give us a more coherent reading experience.
Sure.
But I've never had a course where that was such a problem to kind of grapple with. So yeah, so going back to World War I as the most literary war, I think in a lot of ways it is right. One, and it's part of this is some sociological things that are going on. You have the educational changes of the Victorian era that have caused this explosion in popular literacy, as well as the rapid increase from the same time period in print and periodical culture, which just means people are accustomed to reading, and also more and more people are accustomed to writing. So you have more and more working class writers or lower middle class writers, as opposed to the production of literary material being the work of the literary elite or the cultural elite. And so you have this army where people are just so accustomed to reading and writing, and that makes it very easy for them to produce work and also to consume work, whether that's about the war or other things. A lot of what they're reading in the trenches is actually not war material as well, which is really fascinating. Another interesting effect of this being a literary war is that because the Western Front is so close to home, it is incredibly easy for soldiers to quickly receive books and newspapers from England. And so you have soldiers who will write back to their family in the UK and say, I would really like a copy of this book that came out last month. Can you send it to me? And sometimes within a week, they would have a copy of it, if not even less. And so there was just this very quick delivery time back and forth. So books were shipped to the trenches quickly and easily, and then circulated among soldiers in the trenches. Newspapers also came very rapidly. Also, one of my favorite details is that you had the production of trench newspapers themselves. Huh. Soldiers on the front lines were producing material, newspapers and magazines, for themselves in a variety of ways. Sometimes these were handwritten. They would just take paper they had and produce a handful of copies, writing them by hand, and then circulate them. Sometimes they would make use of military printing materials and supplies in order to produce them on actual printing materials. And then sometimes they found printing equipment in towns that had been evacuated and then just made use of those as well behind the front lines and then circulated those newspapers or magazines up to the front lines. And so just the sheer quantity of printed material that's produced is incredible. Even away from the front lines, you have conscientious objectors in prison who are also producing newspapers in prison, sometimes on squares of toilet paper, which they would then post in toilet stalls for the other prisoners to read because they were forbidden to actually speak to each other. And so just the impetus to write everywhere is remarkable, and they produce a tremendous amount of material as a result.
Talking with Dr. Elizabeth Fredericks about the British literature of World War I these early days here, what do some of the early war poems reveal about how that conflict was imagined before people really understood what was happening?
Yes, there's this real notion, especially in the early days of 1914, of defending both small nations like Belgium and also defending Englishness itself. There's a lot of pastoralism in these early poems, a very idealized picture of rural England that poets like John Masefield and John Freeman invoke in their particular work. And so they give this sort of very idealized rural place and have people think this, imagine this, this is what you're fighting for, this sort of heart of Englishness, which is also such a fascinating move because most of the soldiers on the front lines don't actually come from there. Most of them come from industrial environments. And so it's a very imagined world that they're kind of being encouraged to fight for. Thomas Hardy, interestingly, is one of the few who sees this war from very early stages as a real rupture between the two nations who are linked in many ways, reflecting on the fact that their monarchs are cousins, for instance, by intellectual and artistic traditions that become very entwined in the 19th century. Like other English writers, he does blame the Germans for the war primarily as the aggressors who have started it. But he finds it appalling. He finds it a real shift from what he sees as this 19th century culture of exchange and mutual improvement that is just suddenly warped and defaced into violence and horror.
Elizabeth Fredericks from Hillsdale's English Department is with us. We continue our introduction to British literature of World War I in just a moment. I'm Scott Bertram. This is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
This is Carl Bott and Ted Leidy.
We want to invite you to our show, Man Up, the fourth Thursday of each month, right here on KCNR 96.5 FM and 1460 AM.
Man Up, 6 to 7 p.m., where we explore the lost art of being a man.
Spirits, cigars, and hit the ground running when you get up in the morning. That's what Man Up's going to be about.
Oh, don't forget motorcycles, guns, and hard work every day.
And those things that men talk about when women aren't around.
That's right, even cooking sometimes.
Even cooking sometimes. People, places, and things.
Serving your family, your community, and your country.
Man Up, fourth Thursday of each month from 6 to 7 p.m. right here on Free Fire Radio.
I'm
I'm Tracy Edwards, CEO of the Redding Rancheria. Giving back to our local community is a tradition that is firmly rooted in our history.
Hi, I'm Carrie Crancy, CEO of the Community Foundation of the North State, and we are so grateful for the partnership of the Redding Rancheria over 20 years and counting.
Hi, I'm Jenna Berry with Raising Shasta. We love partnering with the Rancheria. They've been a huge supporter of us for years in so many ways. You know, they help us with our fundraisers, and especially when we come to planting pinwheels.
Redding Rancheria, proud to play our part.
Join me, Mark Levin, weekday afternoons from 3 to 6 on 96.5 FM and 1460 AM. KCNR, your talk radio.
Donald Trump is doing something that's never been done in American history. Now, what Trump is trying to do all at once, he wants to, what I call, reindustrialize America.
Mark Levin is on the radio.
KCNR, your talk radio.
This is Ted Leidy with Northern Firearms Instruction. Obtaining a California concealed weapons license will allow the licensed individual to transport a listed handgun in their vehicle or on their person in public. For application instructions, training, and other information, contact NFI at 530-999-1822 or visit us online at usgunpro.com. This is Ted Leidy, and remember, it's our right and our responsibility.
Since 2019, Organic Pilates has been helping Redding build stronger bodies, not just for summer, but every season of life. Experience matters. We don't teach exercises. We teach to the body in front of us. The best way to start is with our $99 new student intro. One semi-private session, two group reformer classes, and an infrared sauna session. Visit us downtown with free parking. We're right in between curated and theory coffee. Your Pilates story starts here.
We're back on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. I'm Scott Bertram. Dr. Elizabeth Fredericks is with us, Associate Professor of English here at Hillsdale College, as we continue our conversation about British literature of World War I. Dr. Fredericks.
Poems by Rupert Brooke are covered in the class, too. Why are his poems so powerful and so persuasive at the time?
Yes. So there's, one is that he is a poet on the rise, so he's already a pretty well-respected and admired young poetic figure, very talented, by all accounts, also very beautiful, so he has this kind of public persona that's built on both his appearance as well as his work.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's that name recognition that comes. It's also impossible to avoid the fact that he dies very, very early in the war, and tragically not even in conflict. He dies of septicemia from an infected mosquito bite that he actually retains in 1914. So he barely even makes it to combat in a meaningful way. Nonetheless, he does a lot of the things that we sort of talk about. He presents this very beautiful, again, rural, idealized England that he imagines he's fighting for. He also there's this very interesting, very beautiful religious tone, famously in his five-part sonnet sequence, The Soldier. He gives us that line about thank God who has matched us with this hour, and the sense that this is going to be something that makes people better versions of themselves. There's mm-hmm. this image of idealized masculinity that he offers, this idea of like soldiers into clean water slipping is one of the images that he gives. And then in the fifth poem of that sequence, he gives this idea of if I should fall in battle, think of that as there's some corner of England that is forever there now. Like, if I die abroad, Englishness is there too. Mm-hmm. And so we sort of spread it in this way. Our ideals, our virtues, our beauty are kind of everywhere. And it's a sort of romantic death that he offers, one that's very in line with all these young public school men raised upon classical literature and this ideal of dying in battle gloriously and beautifully. These poems, I think, kind of feed upon that and offer that as well. And so it's just this intensely idealized, gorgeous picture that he offers of what it means to go and fight and then also what it may mean to go and die, that downplays the terror and elevates the nobility of what he thinks that he is doing.
Idealized masculinity is a phrase you use. Do we see that? Do we see duty? Do we see sacrifice that become integral parts of this early writing?
There's a lot, and Kipling is one of the most interesting writers to turn to see some of this. One thing you do see is a lot of Christ-like imagery that appears, particularly in his work. If you look at his poem, The Children, for instance, where he's talking about, because Kipling, of course, is too old to go and fight himself and has incredibly poor eyesight, so they wouldn't take him even if he wasn't over 40 years old. But so he's reflecting on the children of people like himself who are going off to fight. And he has the remarkable line that he says, where they bought us anew with their blood. And you're like, that's just this inevitable Christ-like image that he's offering of the sacrifice that the soldiers are giving. And this is, of course, his poetry in the early days there as well. His very famous poem from very early in the war, from almost the literal beginning, For All We Have and Are, gives this very borderline religious as well as patriotic duty that you must go fight because it's not just what your country asks of you, but in some way it must be what God is asking of you too. And so both the duty and sacrifice elements there have this very strong religious pull that's very hard to resist there.
Talking with Dr. Elizabeth Fredericks about the British literature of World War One in the early days right now. The 39 steps, it's not about trench warfare, but it is in this World War One conversation. Why does it belong?
Yeah, so the 39 Steps is by the novelist and politician John Buchan. And it's not explicitly about trench warfare. It was also the very first thing we read in this class. And my students, the day they came in to talk about the first day, they just looked slightly puzzled. And I was going, I bet you guys didn't think you were allowed to have this much fun in a class about World War One literature. And they went, no, we did not expect that. Because it is a tremendously fun novel. Now, Buchan doesn't fight in the war, but he has this history in British government and military. He was stationed in South Africa after the Boer War in Lord Kitchener's kindergarten, as it was called, which is a number of young sort of upwardly mobile people who become political and economic figures in Britain later. And so he's one of those. When he returns to England, he remains involved in the civil service. And in 1915, we actually don't have a very good handle on what he was doing, which has led some to suspect he was doing intelligence work. but he also at one point is ill, or maybe he says he's ill and he's actually doing intelligence work. Again, it's a little fuzzy for people who've actually dug into it. But that's the time period in which he writes the 39 Steps, is in early 1915. And so the war has begun, and Buchan has this eye towards morale on the home front from the very beginning. Significantly, he does become the director of information in 1917, which makes him a propaganda, essentially the head of propaganda for the British government. And he later becomes the head of intelligence. So very interested in morale, in what people are thinking, and in controlling the image of the war. Mm-hmm. And so the 39 Steps, while it's not explicitly about the war, if we think of it as propaganda writing, about that's indirectly about the war, it fits very well. It's not about trench warfare, but it is about a conspiracy to start an international war in Europe by assassinating a head of state, suggestively headed by German conspirators. So all it's barely subtext that it's about World War One. And so it's written very early in the war. It's serialized in Blackwood's Edinburgh Magazine in summer 1915 and then published in full in the fall. And it's a thriller. It's essentially just a domestic espionage thriller with this main character, Richard Hannay, who's just an ordinary guy. Mm-hmm. No one particularly special, as he goes to great pains to point out. He just stumbles into this conspiracy rather by accident and then has to do something about it because he's just a good, straightforward, honest British man, made his pile in South Africa, has this connection to Scotland. And so this is sort of the figure that you have. Mm-hmm. He's very ordinary, like your soldiers who are fighting in the war. Not particularly prominent, not particularly skilled in special things, but he just has this decency of character and this determination to do what's right and to do what must be done. And because he has spent this time in South Africa, he also has a remarkable number of practical skills as well.
Uh-huh.
So that's very helpful. And it's immensely popular in the trenches. There's a soldier who writes to Buchan saying that he ripped through the whole thing in a single night when he was posted on the front lines. So it gets passed around and is immensely popular. And it does give you this character of like, oh, yes, here are what ordinary British citizens are capable of, which is foiling tremendous evil just through their sort of practical intelligence, common sense, and basic decency. And he goes on then to write multiple, he writes multiple Hannay novels throughout World War I that continue to be very popular, and then continues, of course, to write them after World War I as well. But it's this immensely popular trench novel, and like I said, immensely popular work of propaganda fiction as well when you look at it that way.
So if literature was providing a morale boost or providing some reassurance to the home front during the beginning days and years of, well, beginning months of the war, let's say, where do we first begin to see some cracks forming in that confident story of the war?
You see the cracks begin to form throughout 1915 as it becomes clear that this war is not going to be one of a consistently moving front or these interesting and quick offenses that create rapid changes in the conditions of the war. But they really expand significantly in 1916 with the particularly devastating battles of that year that continue into 1917 as well. The long Battle of the Somme in the summer in particular is just especially horrifying for the soldiers who are fighting. And numerous soldiers serve in that battle. The novelist David Jones, for instance, himself points to 1916 as a year where it really felt like things changed. And you just have such heavy casualties mm-hmm. in these battles where you have, for instance, 1 million casualties in a single day of particularly terrible offenses. And just it's really impossible to maintain that sort of bright and lively picture of the war you get from something like the 39 Steps. It's hard to maintain that sense of sort of clean, idealized beauty that you get from Rupert Brooke. The soldiers are suffering from things like trench foot, which is what happens when you're wearing all these wet shoes mm-hmm. and wet socks for days upon days. And so, yes, the struggle of all of that just becomes more miserable. When your reality is rats and lice, it's hard to be rosy about the situation that's happening and go, yes, indeed, this is the idealized picture of the world that we yeah. came here to fight for.
In part two, we'll talk about telling the truth about what's happening in those trenches during World War I. Dr. Elizabeth Fredericks with us, Associate Professor of English at Hillsdale College, talking about her course on the British literature of World War I. Dr. Fredericks, thanks for joining us on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
That will wrap up this edition of the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. Our thanks to Seth Barron, his book Weaponized, The Left's Capture and Destruction of America's Sacred Institutions, and Dr. Elizabeth Fredericks from Hillsdale's English Department. Remember, you can hear new episodes every week on this station. You also can find extended versions of some of our interviews or listen anytime to the podcast. Find it at podcast.hillsdale.edu or wherever you get your audio. Until next week, I'm Scott Bertram, and this has been the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Alan Gordon, Coachmaster Auto Body. You've been in an accident with your vehicle. You call your insurance. The first thing they do is tell you where to go to get an estimate and repairs. Well, tell them where to go. And come see us at Coachmaster. They're sending you to their discount repair shop to get the cheapest repair possible. This is not in your best interest. You have the right to choose Coachmaster to do your repairs. All we need is your claim number and we can handle the entire process. At Coachmaster, we don't repair your vehicle for the insurance company. We repair it for you. We use quality parts and products to ensure the highest quality repairs. Your vehicle will be returned to a pre-loss condition. And yes, if we can't fix it, no one can.
Coachmaster Collision Repair continues to be the leader in the North State for advanced technology in the collision repair industry. Remember Coachmaster on East Side Road. Learn more online at CoachmasterAutobody.com.
This Hawaiian mini vacation is brought to your radio by Maui Bob's Office Cleaning. So what does professional office cleaning have to do with relaxing in a tropical paradise? Frankly, nothing. But Maui Bob and the crew want to remind you to be sure to take the time for what's important in this workaday world. Family, friends, and yes, even yourself. And if their professional office cleaning services can help you make that time, give them a call at 221-5868. This Hawaiian mini vacation was brought to your radio by Maui Bob's Office Cleaning, 221-5868.
Join Aaron and Bill for We the People Radio, Sundays, noon until 2.
It's conservative talk radio with a liberal dose of humor. Get the whole story from experts around the world delivering facts rather than opinion.
Miss the show? Busy at noon? No problem. Listen to our free archives when you have time. No commercial interruptions or download restrictions. We the People Radio.
.us.
This is Colonel Danny Gillum, the host of Front Lines of Freedom, the nation's largest military news and talk radio show. We address the most pressing issues facing the security of our nation, our armed forces, our veterans, and their families. Please join us every Saturday morning from 6 to 8 on 96.5 FM and 1460 AM KCNR, your talk radio show.
The news from Town Hall is brought to you on KCNR Shasta Reading by Shasta Regional Medical Center. Your life, your health, your choice. Shasta Regional Medical Center.